Tony Norman were standing on, which is not normal. It's not very usually open to the public. The McMillan Park site, this historic site, and are actually underground at the moment. But take us on a tour of this historic site.
Well, we're here at the corner of Michigan Avenue and North Capitol Street. It's that weird site that everybody's wondering about. It's the McMillan Reservoir site. It's a slow sand filtration plant that was put out of operation in the 1980s, and the District of Columbia bought the site, and it's been sitting idle since. We're presently inside, underground, one of the cells that's about an acre long and an acre wide. There are about 24 of these underground cells, and they were used to purify the water. Inside the cell, you have about 3 or 4 feet of sand and gravel. So the water was pumped into the cell and sort of percolated through and pumped into a purified filter. So you had a natural purification process that was in play here. To describe the scene, on top of the cell, you have manhole covers. There's about 2,000 of them on the site. They were used for ventilation and lighting. And the workers would spread the sand out in the cell and clean the sand. And the water came in, the unpurified water, and it just percolated through and cleaned the water through the natural sand filtration process. Once again, on this site, there's about 24 of the cells here. They're unreinforced concrete. One or two of the cells have collapsed. That's simply because they haven't been maintained, and part of the site is sinking on the southern end because there's a creek that runs underneath the site. When they constructed the site, they had to fill it in every year to maintain the stability. But since the district had the site, they haven't filled it in since the 80s, so it's been 20 years of neglect. So the other two have collapsed. But those that are here in the center of the site are very stable and still, some of them are actually operational.
Talk about the structure. It's kind of like almost Roman looking at it. These pillars and the concave ceilings, which apparently the bottom is like as well. It's dark, except there are a few of the manholes are open. It's really an amazing site.
Yes, we have, if we can describe it, there are columns in with a curved ceiling that looks like a cathedral, actually, or a temple or a church monument. And you have about, at least 50 columns, 50 to 75 columns that hold the curved ceilings up. Maybe someone could even do some paintings on the ceilings. Unique paintings, but it has a religious cathedral feel to it when you describe the actual cell.
What, there are 24 of these 1 acre by 1 acre, 24 of these different cells that are on the site.
That's right. They're individualized, they're compartmentalized, so there's about 24 of them, and each one is roughly an acre long and an acre wide.
So let's go back up outside, above ground, and talk about some of the history of this site, Tony Norman.
Well, the site was part of the history of Washington, D.C. It was a natural reservoir, and it was originally, they used the site to pump water to the White House, actually, in the U.S. Capitol. That was the original use of the site. That's where the water came from. And they also used the water for any fires that happened in Washington, D.C. It was landscaped by Frederick Law Olmsted, Jr. and the Olmsted firm. That's the same firm that did the landscaping for New York Central Park. And they did the White House landscaping, the Capitol building, and the old Soldiers' Home. And they did about 10 or 15 other parks in the nation here. So that's part of the history. And it also has some historic vistas. When you're on the roof of the site, you can see the U.S. Capitol building, the Washington Monument. You can see the Basilica at Catholic University. You can see the Howard University Tower and the old Soldiers' Home Tower. So these were considered very dramatic and historic vistas that were part of the historic aspect of the site. Originally in the Olmsted, the LaFont plan, Washington was to be surrounded by parks. And this was going to be one of the parks that would surround the city of Washington. Originally, Washington was surrounded by forts during the Civil War. And they wanted to turn every one of those forts into parks. And they would connect them, and McMillan would be one of the connections of the parks that would surround Washington, D.C. And we can take a look in one of the regulator houses. These regulator houses have terracotta roofs, and they're made of brick. There's four of them on the site. And then you also have 24 large silos or towers that stored the sand. And on those towers, they are covered with ivy. Naturally, not well planted ivy that was specifically planted to grow on those towers. So to give you a site, in the center of a 24-acre site, you have two alleyways or causeways. And in those causeways, you have 10 towers and two regulator houses in each causeway that divides the site up into three separate sections.
So let's look in one of these structures. And this would clean the sand, and then the sand would be transported into the cells where it would act like a coffee filter, and what the water would be put on top, filtered down through the sand into underground network of tunnels, which then piped out clean water. So you're filtering water without any chemicals.
That's right. That's right. What we're looking at now is a sand tower that stores the sand. And originally they would draw the sand out and put them in the cells. And the way it worked, once again, as you described, was the natural purification process. The water percolated in the sand, and the pure water came out at the bottom, and they just pumped it out into the aquifer, the pure water aquifer across the street.
They would have to then clean the sand?
They would have to then clean the sand. They clean the sand roughly every 20 days. So there's about 30 cells, and only about half of them were in operation. The other half were always being cleaned.
Labor intensive?
It's very labor intensive. They may have had over 200 workers on the site. That's one of the reasons why they stopped using it. They finished building the chemical plant in 81 or 82. And once that was completed, they stopped using this site. So now whereas they had 200 workers, they probably only need 10. So that was the driving force of closing it down.
As we go up into the middle of the site, the vistas are incredible. And this park, historic in nature, was accessible prior to World War II?
Yes, the public could come around the site prior to World War II in the 30s and 40s. In fact, many of the senior residents remember coming on the site and sleeping on the site during the hot summers. In fact, it was one of the first integrated parks in the nation, and not on purpose, because at night, on the hot summer nights, the residents just simply came on the site and they slept on the site. And many residents I've been confronted, white and black, elderly residents who've stated that they remember coming up and sleeping on the site when it was hot, because the site is very cool. There's always a cool breeze here on the site.
What happened? How did it get the public access get lost?
Well, during World War II, they felt there was a threat to the water supply. So they closed public access and they built a fence around it. And ever since then, the public did not have access. Although they did promise to reopen it when the war was over, but that never happened, so it stayed closed and restricted to the residents. And we can go look at a regulator house right here. Once again, this regulated the flow of water. It's a red brick building with a terracotta roof that's also red. About a one-story building.
And it's amazing that we've recently experienced an earthquake here, and these buildings, more than 100 years old, having been neglected for 20, 30 years now, are in pretty solid, pretty good shape.
Yes, they're in very good shape. It shows you the quality of the work that the craftsmen used. We're inside of a regulated house now, and you may want, you could hear some water still dripping. And in these regulated houses, they regulated maybe 4 or 5 cells. And it handled maybe anywhere from 1 to 10 million gallons of water a day, depending on the flow of how they wanted to regulate the flow of water. So it was all a natural process. They did not use chemicals. Once again, the site is located at the corner of Michigan Avenue and North Capitol Street. The southern border is Channing Street, and to the west is First, goes around 1st to 5th Street, and the northern border is Michigan Avenue. So any the residents probably have seen these strange towers when they were driving down North Capitol Street and wondering what they are. Well, they are the water purification towers. So we're walking on the roof of it that's covered with grass. These are the green roofs that they built in the 1890s. So we're basically on the roof of the structure. And it has about 3 feet of soil and grass on it, and had small bushes and trees on it.
Built by the Army Corps of Engineers?
Built by the Army Corps of Engineers, completed in 1904. And it was declared a national park by William Taft, actually. Declared the site a historic national park in about 1915. And it was named in honor of Senator James McMillan, who was one of the senators who were instrumental in the beautification of Washington, D.C. It was Senator McMillan that actually took the L'Enfant plan and made it operational in terms of beautification. And he died before the site was completed, so it was named in his honor. But we're on the roof now. We're looking to the north of the site. We're seeing the Washington Hospital Center, but to the east of us, we can see the Catholic University Tower and Basilica. And to the south, we could actually see the Capitol, the top of the Capitol Dome, excuse me. And to the west, you can see the Washington Monument. And if you walk around, you can see the Howard University Founders Library Tower. And we can also see the National Cathedral. And so these were very majestic and historic views. It's hard to describe, but if you come on the site, there are some web pages or websites that you can get a feel for it. So that's where we are now. We're on the site, and you get to feel as if you're in a very rural area in the middle of the city. So it's a very peaceful, very quiet place for anyone that I would encourage to come and take a look at.
It's not often that there's public is allowed here that gets access to the site.
Yeah, we have a struggle every year trying to get the public on it. We do about 1 or 2 tours a year. The city gives us a hassle in showing it, because once people come on the site, they're very excited, and once they see what's up here, because you can't see it on the outside, then they want to know, this is something really fantastic. Why don't we do something very creative? The District of Columbia has an opportunity to do something very unique on this site. This site was designated by the National Capital Planning Commission as one of the sites to put a national memorial. The mall is getting overcrowded, so they designated this as the top 10 site to put a national memorial on. So the city has an opportunity to put a national memorial here, to do a national park here, to do some creative things in terms of limited development, park, open space. So they have an opportunity to do something very unique here. And once you actually see the site, you get a better impression of what I'm talking about.
You've laid out some of the history and the potential future of respecting its historic nature. What are some of the plans that the city is trying to move forward with now?
The city now has a very strong development project they're trying to move forward with, which it consists of anywhere from 1.5 to 2 million square feet of development. And that consists of office space, shopping center, luxury condominiums, apartment buildings, and townhouses. So basically, it's to develop every part of the site, and very limited part of the space is utilized for park and open space. So it's a very large development that the city wants to put here. We've been fighting the city for over 15 or 20 years, and now they're trying to move forward to do this dense development. The residents have been very much against it. The residents want to see something happen here, but nothing this large or this dense.
At one point in time, the city could have been given this for free?
Yes. Actually, the national government, the National Park Service, they offered to give the District of Columbia this site for free if they would preserve it as open public green space. But the city chose to pay about $8.9 million for the site because they wanted to develop it for economic purposes. And to some extent, the National Park Service and federal government have offered that if you still devote a substantial part of the site, they may even reimburse part of the money with a desire to keep green park and open space. So yes, the city had that opportunity to do that when they first bought it, but they chose not to do it.
Now, if this massive amount of development goes on here, what will happen to the underground cells that we were just in and to much of this historic site?
Well, for the most part, they proposed demolishing most of the site. It's been estimated 5 years ago just to demolish, it would cost about $65 million just to tear everything down. So they would basically rip everything out and just redo the entire site. That's one of the reasons why it's been difficult to construct the site, because it's about $60 million to demolish it. And that's not counting stabilizing it and then doing the actual construction. So, but the city has been putting up a great deal of the money for the developer. This is the tragedy of this particular site. This site did not go up for competitive bids. Surprisingly, a 25-acre site, with as large as it is, sort of went through the back doors of the city and went to a developer without a competitive bid. And that would the city could have saved a great deal of money, because this has always been a desirable site that many developers would like to bid on this site. If you put it up for competitive bid, the city would not have to put as much public money into it, and you've had a competitive bidding process. But that didn't take place here. And that's a tragedy for this city as well as a tragedy for this nation. And that's one of the things we have been complaining about, that the site should go up for competitive bids.
Talk further about the district's role in this. Normally, it's on the developer to bring forward a PUD, a planned unit development. But the district is breaking new ground here in assisting the developer in doing this.
Yes, this is an extremely unusual process. The district had decided to take the lead and actually do the PUD application. This is extremely unusual. I can't think of any other project that this has happened in the District of Columbia. It's an attempt to try to keep this developer involved in the process and take the risk out of the development. And one of the other things we found out that the district has actually hired these developers as consultants and paying them during this time period as consultants for them to, and the district is actually doing the resources to do the PUD. A PUD is where you go to get the zoning for the site. So this is extremely unusual and unprecedented. It's also extremely unusual and unprecedented because normally they would have to get approval for the disposition of the site before the city council. But they haven't done that. They haven't gone before the city council to get the disposition done. So this entire process is extremely unusual. And the district basically is taking the risk on the development of this site. They are basically operating as the developer themselves when they submit the PUD application.
So correct me if I'm wrong here. Normally the developer has to go to the district government for approval or not of the plan. And in this case, the district government is assisting, helping pay to bring their case to, well, the district government.
That's right. Normally, a developer would say, I'm interested in a site. They would select the developer. That would be, obviously, but it might be a competitive bidding process. And once the developer is selected, they would negotiate a land development agreement. Then the property would go before the district government if it's a contract of a million or more. If it's district property, it would have to go before the city council to be approved by the city council on the land disposition legislation. Then once that is done, it's approved by the council, then the developer buys the site, and then the developer takes it and applies for the zoning and the application, and the risk is on the developer. But they're shifting that risk now, and the district government is actually operating as the developer, paying the developer as a consultant while operating as the developer themselves. This is extremely unprecedented.
And why is it happening?
I believe the only reason it's happening is because they're trying to keep this developer involved in the game. This developer cannot afford to go through this process. This is one of the subsidies that they're giving this developer and trying to make this developer, to keep this developer in play.
And does the public win here? I mean, if this thing were to be reopened and put out to a public bid, might the public stand a better chance of getting a better deal?
Oh, yes. The city would stand a better deal. And there's a lot of developers that may have deep pockets that don't need as much public money to subsidize them to make this project work. I know for a fact there's at least two other major developers that would love to get involved in this project, but it was not up for competitive bid.
One of the previous attempts at development here some years ago was a strip mall.
Yes, years back they tried to put a strip mall back in the late 80s, early 90s. That's one of the reasons we got a federal injunction and went to court, because the city denied that it was a historic site and they were trying to move forward in putting a strip mall here. But once it was declared a historic site, we got a federal injunction to block any development, at least for the time being, for that time.
This, where we're standing, is located in Ward 5. The council member for Ward 5 is Harry Thomas.
Yeah, the council, Harry Thomas, and they've been pushing for development for the site, as was his father, pushed for development for the site. Actually, the site itself falls in two wards, actually. The part where the reservoir is actually in Ward 1, and this part is actually in Ward 5, but the dividing line is First Street. So, but the part where they'll do most of the development is here in Ward 5. And the council member is pushing and in favor of large development.
And the developers, EYA is the main developer here. And you're saying it was sole sourced and Jair Lynch as well?
Yes, they did not go up for competitive bid. It was basically, I guess, who knows who. So it was essentially sole sourced. So it didn't come up for competitive bids for the project. And a lot of that had to do with the pushing of the politicians and others who wanted to give the site to the people that they felt were their partners and friends.
This has been attempted with the strip mall and with other attempts over the years. So it's not the first time that it's looked like something might go through. Is it a done deal now?
No, this is not a done deal. There's still an opportunity for the residents in the city to have an impact on it. They still have to take a land development agreement before the city council. They still have to go before the zoning commission. They still have to go before the historic preservation board. And they still have to get all of these entitlements or regulatory approvals. So there's still an opportunity to shape how this site will look. So if you have any interest in this site, you can still write the mayor and let him know how you feel about the site. So it is not a done deal.
A couple years ago, there were community meetings, and I was surprised to be at them, and the people spoke up, and it was overwhelming, the opposition to the plans that were proposed, and yet somehow it just keeps moving forward.
Well, yes, that's right. The development keeps moving forward because it's a very desirable site. If this site is completely developed, it is estimated to be worth $250 million. And when you have those type of numbers on the table, you're going to always have an aggressive developer that wants to develop the site and the city looking for revenue generating activities. So that prospect alone will always keep a conflict about whether this site should be developed or not.
Tony, you see this as not just a development issue, but an issue of statehood.
Yes, the reason it's an issue of statehood, because other states reserve large amounts of land for preservation and preserve their heritage and their culture. D.C., if it wants to really be a state, it has to act like a state. And this site is part of the history of Washington, D.C. It needs to preserve its history and its culture, because that is what defines you as a state. So if we want to be a state, we need to act like a state and preserve our natural resources. Every state does that. Maryland just set aside millions of acres to preserve its heritage. Other states have done it. Virginia has done it. This is an opportunity for the district to set aside at least 25 acres to preserve its heritage. Every state does it. It is a statehood issue.
How did you get involved?
Well, I moved to the neighborhood when I was still in law school, and many of the senior citizens that remember sleeping on the site were pushing me to get involved with it because the city was pushing for a strip mall. And they would have gone through with it because I was an attorney. They kept pressuring me to get involved with it, to help them out. And so, to tell you the truth, when I first saw it from the outside, I was saying, well, why don't they develop it? It looks like an eyesore. But once I got on the site, I had an entirely different conversion about what needed to be done. So I got involved with the site from the senior citizens who were living in the area, and I lived next door to them. And thanks to them, they got me involved with it.
Any final thoughts that you care to share?
Yes, this is this site is not just a District of Columbia site. It was designated to go on the National Registry of Historic Places. This is part of our national heritage. It's not just the District of Columbia. When you look at the history of developing Washington, D.C. as a national city, this site was a crucial aspect of the L'Enfant Plan. So this is something really the nation needs to take an interest in and Congress needs to take an interest in, because this is part of our national heritage as well as the heritage of the District of Columbia, because you cannot separate the history of the District of Columbia from the history of the nation. So I would just like to let everybody know this is not just a statehood issue, it's a national issue, it's a district issue, it's a local issue. Once you find out about the site, you love the site. So we ask everybody to get involved with it.
Thanks so much, Tony Norman.
Thank you.